SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
You're listening to a program previously aired on WPFW. While this is not a live broadcast, we're proud to bring you this encore presentation filled with the same insight, music, and voices you've come to expect. Stay tuned and enjoy.
Welcome to this hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at your 48-year-old Jazz and Justice radio station, WPFW Washington. We're at 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org, reaching the DMV up into Delaware, over Baltimore, out to West Virginia, down into Northern Virginia, and out to the Eastern Shore. But also we have listeners throughout the world, courtesy of the internet. Those listeners have chosen over 48 years to financially and socially support the station. We're entirely listener supported, and we thank you for that. It's a pleasure to be with you in this hour. School is almost out for many, at least on the collegiate level. There have been many graduation ceremonies, and on levels up to that, students are beginning to close their experience and enter into the summer. That is an important activity of our community, education. And we're going to take a look at the Black teaching tradition. It plays a special role in education. We'll find out how it has evolved through the ages with our guest, Dr. Kenya Ramey, whose extensive experience in education has been shaped by the proverb, "She who learns teaches." Dr. Ramey received her formal education at Virginia State University, first a BA in history, and then later on a doctorate in education, in educational administration and supervision. She also has master's degrees in the disciplines of African American Black studies, and also a specialization in social studies teacher education. She has had leadership roles in various settings and organizations, including being a teacher, a department chair, a curriculum writer, an instructional coach, a program director, a school administrator at the following organizations: the New York City Department of Education, the District of Columbia International School, Delta Research and Educational Foundation, and presently she's at the D.C. Office of the State Superintendent of Education, where she serves as a research director. Dr. Ramey, good morning.
Good morning to you and all the listeners. Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
And it's indeed an honor to talk with you this morning and to talk about that very important subject, education. Well, let's just jump right into it. Absolutely. What are we to understand by the phrase, the Black teaching tradition?
Thank you for that, David. I must say, I would be remiss if I did not offer up the true lineage of what we're calling the Black teaching tradition, if I didn't honor those that have come before me in this work. And I must start off with my own direct lineage of both those who are here in the human physical form, but also in the ancestral realm who have served as Black teachers. I am a fourth generation Black teacher and educator, as my mother is a retired teacher and educator, as well as having my grandmother and great-grandmother having served as Black teachers through what we now know the Black teaching tradition. And then so we think about just even the definition or the understanding of what is Black teaching tradition. It is being talked about in various different spaces. However, just to gain some clarity on what does that consist of? It is truly the characteristics, the roles, and the embodiments that transform Black teachers. It has been known to collectively innovate for over now multiple centuries, and I'll speak about that further, and it also governs the teaching practices and furthers liberation that these Black teachers are implementing. I would also note that it is looking at the lineage of those values and practices and systems that stretch across time and space. And that comes from the Dr. Patricia Koswala Sain's understanding and definition of the Black teaching tradition, how Black people have taught past, present, and future, regardless of time and space.
So the connection, the implication being that even the practice of the oral tradition on the continent, and as it's made its way across the ocean, and in all those settings, operating on what us folk call mother wit, and operating under, how can I say, within our community, we uphold much, but outside our community, often periods of oppression, suppression, constriction. Tell us more, because until you gave us that introduction, I think most people think of a few historic figures, but it really didn't start alone with Carter G. Woodson. You implied before that it started before that. Tell us more.
Sure. So Carter G. Woodson is just a part of that. What I'm looking at in the understanding of the Black teaching tradition, he cultivates like the middle ground of this great lineage. And so we must go back to before we were enslaved Africans. We must go back to when we were freed Africans. And so I look at the great kingdoms of Aksum, the great kingdoms of Kush. I look at the great lineage of Timbuktu, and the institutions that were created in what we now know as ancient Timbuktu, where we were creating the philosophies and the understandings that the world has now studied, right? And the mathematical and the architecture and agricultural systems that were established in the institutions of Timbuktu. Some would argue that in ancient Timbuktu, in this kingdom, is where we have some of our first known higher learning or higher educational institutions established and founded right there on the continent of Africa. So we come from that lineage. I start from there in terms of the Black teaching tradition, where this understanding of time and space, culture, and resonance amongst the teacher to the pupil is communal learning in space. And then we transition and go into our shores of both Northeast, West, and South Africa. And as we know, of both the Arab and of the European invasions into the African continent, many of our ancestors were then taken from the shores, taken from the continent with their teaching traditions, with their oral histories, but also even their practical histories of reading and writing. Because I always like to amplify that we were writing, we were reading, but we were also placing that in the storytelling of who we are.
And well, so you mentioned Timbuktu. I hope people have heard in the news that allegedly ancient buildings are indeed gigantic libraries. And that's not a common. People familiar with the continent would know that there are libraries also in Alexandria or in Central Africa as well. Pardon the interruption. Go right ahead, Doctor.
I think that's very, very intricate and important, right? That those ancient libraries of physical books. I have a colleague of mine who is actually finishing up her doctoral studies over at Howard, writing about this very understanding of those ancient libraries in Timbuktu. She just returned from Mali and sitting with many of the elders and priests in Mali, but also what we now know to be ancient Timbuktu, and those artifacts that are still in place thousands of years later, right? Those original artifacts of ancient Timbuktu. So I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because those same exact physical articles of the library also transported with us internally, spiritually. And that is what we call the Black teaching tradition around this conceptualization of time and space. And so we don't get Carter G. Woodson, an Anna Julia Cooper, an Ida B. Wells, a Maria Church Terrell, without having a Timbuktu. Right? An ancient Timbuktu, an ancient Kush, an ancient Aksum. We don't get that unless we also have those oral traditions of many of the traditional African practices of those Africans that were now being introduced to the shadow enslavement of the diaspora, both here in the American, the North American, but also the Caribbean and the South American shores prior to them. So this is what I'm saying around that teaching tradition, both in the time and space, but the physical and the spiritual understanding of this conceptualization.
So you're sharing with us gives excitement from the imagery and the actualities. It would not be uncommon, especially under the conditions of enslavement, to have multi-generational instruction, whether it's the Hush Harbor or some form of the eventual evolution of camp meetings, crossing traditions, crossing languages, crossing worldviews. All that was happening. Maybe it's a little bit of a rush. I'm mindful of our allotment of time. But when those were observed by people of non-African cultures who were in control and authority of the land space that these settings would occur, people were penalized and punished, whipped, even some possibility of a death penalty. And those who would even dare teach them, especially if they were of another persuasion, would be fined and ostracized in the community. Can you just tell us more, as it's germane or relevant to how we're pursuing how this tradition survived and lasted?
Absolutely. And so you mentioned hush harbors. I would even include the concepts of ring shouts, right? I would even include this idea of speaking and learning our language prior to the English, the French, and the Spanish, right? I would even speak to how we preserve by intertwining this new introduced language and way of life to preservation of our past, of our soil. And so you think about the hush harbors, the ring shout. You even think about for many, many Africans who are now being introduced to, or in my opinion, reintroduced, right, to and being forced to this very Europeanized concept of religion, right? Where it's okay, we're going to reclaim what is already ours because, you know, what we know is the, what you're introduced is European religion. This was actually ours prior, okay? And so how we then take Proverbs and various different passages that we're forced to learn either through memory and some were actually taught through reading as well, right? Let's speak on that and how we utilize that for our freedom and liberation. So you look at the Nat Turners, you look at the Denmark Vesey's, you look at even what Aiete and what the first free Black Republic did in Haiti, right? And what those Africans did in utilizing not only language, culture, and spirituality, religious ceremonial practices, that too I would encompass into the teaching tradition of us memory and knowing, but most importantly of us practicing what is at bay. And so the hush harbor, the ring shout, the proverbial rehearsing, the singing and the song and the dance, that will go into my understanding as an education as both the formal and the informal learning practices of a Black teacher.
Allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to Dr. Kenya Ramey. Dr. Ramey is an educator with specific focuses on what we call pedagogy, the craft and then some of the actuality of teaching, and involves curriculum development, administrative rigors and such. We're talking about the Black teaching tradition. You're listening to We the People for this hour right here on your Jazz and Justice radio station, WPFW 89.3 FM. Again, Dr. Ramey, thank you for getting us launched into this very important subject. You know, I alluded to extra-legal and legal suppressions when it comes to African-descended folks trying to educate themselves and meet and form a society in an environment that would be reflective of learning. This occurred not only in the South, but also in various northern states, and as the United States expanded. I want to particularly give you the leading example that I'm mindful in Reconstruction period that when Black representation reached a majority sense in state legislatures, public education systems were established for all students, and sadly, they were resisted in many, many social and, again, extra-legal, i.e. violent ways. Can you take us out into that period and further down the road in our history with the Black teaching tradition?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some of our first and this is when it gets really interesting for me. Right. This is when I really lighten up as a student of history or her story, but also as a former in classroom teacher of history. I have taught the social studies and the history. Right. So this is where it buzzes in the sense of now we're forming official institutions of education. Right. Through nook or cranny, as our folks say, through the officials and the unofficial, the policies in place or not, in post-enslavement during the Reconstruction era and of the 19th century. And so ultimately, you will now have formerly enslaved Africans here in the Americas, here in this particular country, in this state, right, in this regime, where we're going to, you might give us a school, but you might not, but we're still going to establish it anyway, anyhow. So then you have our HBCUs, our historically Black college and institutions, growing and developing and buzzing of formerly enslaved Africans, of even Black folk who are now in the North, who maybe they are free Black folk, right, who are now going off into our institutions to become some of our first trained teachers. And so I often tell tell the story of how many of your elders who could not read or write, but they sent off a child, a student, a grandchild, a cousin. You know, we know it as play cousins, but as we know, many of us were connected simply because we were connected, right? Coming out of enslavement. And so the first one who goes off and gets a formal education comes back and educates the entire family, the basic reading and writing skill sets, reading math and arithmetic is what they called reading and arithmetic. It's like, how can we now teach our grandmother who wants to simply read the Bible, who wants to simply learn how to write her name? Or how do we now teach the next generation of children that we'll see coming through, the Carter G. Woodsons, the Annie Julia Cooper, the Mary McLeod Bethunes, right? How do we now even show even your Booker T. Washingtons? How do we now cultivate this learning mechanism beyond reading and writing, but creating and crafting skill sets that expands our understanding of teaching and learning? And so we see these institutions coming out of the Hush Harbor, the Ring Shout. We have our HBCUs that are established, right? But then we also have such schools where the government was giving funding, such as the Rosenwald schools throughout, with all its problematic policies that were engaged with that. You have many Black folk that were educated through this particular governmental or even philanthropic funding, right? One of many that then we're Black teachers. You might have one, maybe two classrooms who are now formally educated, who are now teaching roughly anywhere from 25 to 75 children a day in particular classroom settings. And this is what you're now seeing established. And then you come through with the M Street schools, such as that what we have here in Washington, D.C., that establishes a certain level of intellectual genealogy.
So you talked about the Rosenwald schools that were peppered throughout, mostly the South, heading a little bit toward the Midwest as well. And you talked about, or at least alluded to, that some of this was the, the embattlement or outgrowth of political legislative decisions. But most importantly, there were efforts of mutual aid of Black philanthropy, particularly on the part of many of the, as Black denominations of the Christian tradition came of age in the 19th century. You can think about many schools that were established. Morris Brown College is something that stands out in my mind, for instance. And you mentioned Booker T. Washington, and Tuskegee, of course, would be something that comes to mind. In all of this, there's still a sense of somewhat of a safe or rested place to learn in the midst of a chaotic environment. Do you want to say more about the establishment of HBCUs, or even take us further that, yes, we're building institutions, but these activities embrace all of the modalities of community?
Yes. So the historic, but also the very relevant understanding of HBCUs being a product of HBCU and coming from family members who have attended and graduated from our various different HBCUs throughout the country, right? The significance of the institutions that were being established throughout each state, right, plays a major role in how Black children, how Black folk were going beyond your traditional now K through 12 setting and going into both private and state funded HBCUs, right? And there's some levels of differences that we saw then and now in terms of the cost or the affordability or the accessibility of our HBCUs. And then even, let's be real, the types of Black folk that might have gone to those HBCUs that were still established for Black folk, but depending upon the cost or depending upon the reputation in the state. And so I believe the HBCU as an institution, right, and as a longstanding institution that I am committed to fighting for and advocating for, plays a role in these the teaching tradition, because you not only have your traditional schools of education, your colleges of education, your pathways for, at the time, might have been colored teachers, right? However, you're now bringing in your great intellectuals in the turn of that century, right? So in these early 1900s, you're bringing in the Du Bois, the Carter G. Woodson. You're bringing in, you have Mary McLeod Bethune alone, who's creating her own institution for Black women and Black girls. And so you're seeing how it is now bringing in many of us who had to go off after we got our traditional learning and obtained advanced degrees. We're coming back home to establish the institution outside of the politics. And we're educating the teacher. We're educating the future counselor and principal. But we're also educating our next agriculturalists and engineers. We're also now educating beyond that our greatest mathematicians that might become some of our, become our community accountants to show us and teach us about our numbers, right? We are then seeing how the HBCU will do that and continues to do that today, arguably graduates the largest amount of Black children and Black people in our country.
Listeners, you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. More importantly, I repeatedly ask you to focus on the subject at hand at this hour. That is the Black teaching tradition. To explain this important sense of movement, tradition, practice, is Dr. Kenya Ramey. Dr. Ramey is an educator. She has served various roles, that of teacher, department chair, curriculum writer, instructional coach, program director, and educational administrator. She brings all those talents to explain the Black teaching tradition. We're at the halfway point in our program, and I would just ask that you stick with us so you get a complete presentation of an important subject this morning. But before we do that, we will serve you by providing public service announcements. Stick with us. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, DMV. Sankofa presents a community celebration in the midst of the madness, cuz it's Mama Lucy Murphy's 75th birthday. Hey, ho. Sunday, September 14th, 2 to 6 p.m. at Sankofa Cafe, 2714 Georgia Avenue Northwest. The afternoon is a fundraiser for WPFW and will feature an open mic with hosts Esther Herbero and Nkechi Taifa, just to name a few, and for you to sing, play, or present poetry or hip-hop. An afternoon of collective effervescence, honoring one of our own sheroes and supporting WPFW. Details at sankofa.com.
Thank you so much, David. And so indeed, challenges, but also successes, right? Weathering the storm is what they say. And so you mentioned or highlighted some of the names, and I'll even bring us up into some current day, right? Leading off with the nanny Helen Burroughs, right? And her knowledge and formal training at the M Street School here in Washington, D.C. And then you have your Septima Clark, right? Who is a teacher activist, right? Who grounded us in community and learning and engagement, right? However, was very much a part of the revolutionary civil struggle here of the 1900s and 20th century, and supporting and going into this concept of what we now know to be the freedom schools, right? Who have had this grounding and longstanding tradition, they too of the Black teaching tradition that formalized that hush harbor, that ring shout concept throughout the summers throughout the South, throughout Mississippi, et cetera, in the 1960s, the freedom schools. So we even see how those freedom schools then continue to cultivate and reestablish themselves in the 90s. And I'm talking about the 1990s, right? But into the 2000s, where it was reformulated and reignited around this teaching traditional practice called the freedom schools. Your Ella Bakers, an activist, a supporter of student activism, but yet very clear on the teaching practices within how we train and develop young people. And then I also want to drop some names that people are like, okay, you know what, Dr. Ramey, I don't know if they're of the teaching tradition. And then I would argue, indeed, they are. So your Tony K. Bambaras, yes. Your Bell Hooks, your Jacob Carruthers, understandably and without argument, your Michelle Foster. But then we see many of our contemporary scholars of the Gloria Ladison Billings, the Joyce E. Kings. And I would be remiss if I did not discuss and name and drop name, right, of some of people who have influenced me directly that were taught by the likes of a Jacob Carruthers, my big brother alone, Dr. Carr, Greg Kamathi Carr, right, and understanding even the freedom school practice and this teaching traditional practice in and of itself, the Dana Kings and some of my peers, the Kamika Royals. I can go on and on in terms of the lineage of those Black teaching tradition, both teachers, academics, scholars, but also practitioners in this tradition itself.
Yeah, as you were talking, I was thinking of the Ladner sisters, mm-hmm. and Joyce Ladner and Dory Ladner, especially Fannie Lou Hamer. People think of the political activism, but the fact that she established and taught co-ops and farming for the benefit of the whole community. Did I just say Frances Cress Welsing? So,
not, but I'm glad you did.
Yeah. So, you know, taking that practice of psychology and making it accessible and quite relevant and quite helpful to the community. These are just a few of the people. And again, the appreciation of your remarks is, it's not just outstanding personal charisma. It's not the one person being the hero of the hour or the moment. It's a reflection of coming from a community, being part of a community, and being accountable to a community. We have a good amount of time, and there are many directions to go. I'd like to explore a few more things about the Black teaching tradition. Let's be deliberate about it. We both have illustrated some degree of a Pan-African sense of this tradition. In what ways was it maybe international? In what ways was it practiced demonstrably in households? Those are two different places, but I just offer those up for a start.
Yeah, so I'll start with household, and then I will discuss and talk international as well. So households, and we can kind of go a different direction with this as well, but in households, the Black teaching tradition is that ancestral lineage development, right? It is how Black people teach and learn regardless. And I go back to regardless of that time and space. So households can look like, my example is my mother, who was a teacher, that brings home her leftover school supplies and sets up a mini classroom for her children to continue to learn outside of your traditional classroom time and space. Right? That's one example. Another example is how ways in which Black families and Black communities have created academic or educational settings through either their religious and spiritual communities, right? So both in your traditional church communities, as well as in your traditional mosque or Muslim communities, there are always some form of a learning and engagement for young people that's created, a continuous learning that incorporates reading and writing and that arithmetic, that math skill set.
You know, you mentioned religious traditions and the practice. A lot of people think this is just in the stratosphere of academia, but the practice of rhetoric, that spoken word, speeches, presentations that are public, really do matter. The words that are used there are just not hot air. They represent power, dynamism, energy, purpose. And that's an appreciation that I share with you about the Black teaching tradition, a sense of people taking up their own discipline, often when they're little ones growing into bigger ones and then growing into adulthood.
Yeah, that call and response is everything. That repetition is everything, right? And that too is African, right? That is ours to claim, to own, and continue to carry. And so that repetition, that song, that dance that we encourage and inspire, as an educator, I've always been an advocate of the ways in which you are taught and learned and engaged in our household, when it's done through a very clear lens, right? When we are in here, that is the first learning space, the first incubator space for any little Black child, right? And so that call and response, that oral tradition, those histories, those remembrance of those that come before us, the respect, the honor to our elders, the cooking in the kitchens, the singing and the song dance on a Saturday morning, right? Whether you gotta put on a little Anita Baker or a Sly and a Family Stone, giving some honor to his transition. But even that is a part of the traditional practices of teaching and learning.
Yes, certainly the arts, especially musicianship, is a reflection of, dare I say, not only individual genius, but collective movement and power as well.
Can I also add?
Sure, please do.
Be the Black intellectual genius that I would then say that is resonated within our community.
Also, you know, the benefit to this country, you know, you've gracefully got us through the 18th and the 19th centuries into the 20th and now the 21st. I was talking to someone, community setting, and we were talking about if you took away all the patents and all the inventions, you know, no Zoom, no traffic light, no iron, no gas mask, no ice cream, no lubricant for trains, no security system, no personal health care products for everyone. All those things would be gone if it wasn't for this tradition. I believe that it's not only tangible, but it's so much of culture in the atmosphere and accessible that we practice this in ways that we're not even always self-conscious about, but neither do we take it for granted. So that's a long preamble to lead to this. One of the things that's observable with the Black teaching tradition is it's an engine for inclusion. What would it mean not to include a James Baldwin or an Audre Lorde? So it demonstrates within the community a willingness to learn from each other regardless of differences or demographics or be they positive or negative.
Oh, no, absolutely. James Baldwin, your Audre Lordes, you know, we cannot have this tradition without them, with all voices, with all, because Black folk.
The Harlem Renaissance demonstrate, yeah.
Whole Renaissance, indeed. We would not have many of our ways of knowing. And, you know, Maya Angelou have spoken of this as well. If we did not engage in the tradition or the rhetoric, but most importantly, respect, honor, and place within, right? We cannot exclude any one of our community members. So Black folk and all of our mirrored identities is a part of that educational, that traditional practice, understanding Black teaching in and of itself. And I want to just say, mention one person who, you know, we spoke of Maya and James, but I got to talk about Nikki Giovanni, who she and of itself had a very clear conversation, a clear consciousness around her identity as Black and woman, right? But yet very clear that you must and will always include me. And this is what we have done, because she, her rhetoric of it of itself, and then being a educational practitioner as a teacher, both as a teacher in and of our community spaces, but as a teacher in and of the academic spaces as well, but always was very clear in who she was at the core and what tradition she came from in terms of the Black village, the Black community, and her family alone, always paying homage and reverence to what she would say, the Appalachian, you know, mountains and community and her country Black folk that least we forget that she came from.
You know, as you're talking, the conjure becomes infinite. Sister Sonia Sanchez, of course, we have many people who can practice what forms, whether it's the tanka or the haiku, this world creation thing is going on. The renewal of speculative fiction with Nilo Hopkinson, Octavia Butler, and Kay Jemison. Again, it's the Black teaching tradition. We have strong selves, but it's not all about self. It just... By its nature, there's multiplicity, there's engagement, there's connectivity. Doctor, let's allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to Dr. Kenya Ramey. We're talking about the Black teaching tradition right here on We the People on your Jazz and Justice radio station, WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. Over 100 programmers covering music and culture, news and public affairs, try to build a better world, better communities, one broadcast at a time. We do that because listeners like yourselves choose to support us financially. That is crucial. I'll give you some reasons why. On Wednesdays at 3, Sophie's Parlor, music and culture by women for everyone, goes from 3 to 5. At 2 o'clock, Shay Wanana with Zen El Amin covers Middle Eastern affairs. Mentioned earlier, Africa Now with host and producers Moisa Mutali and James Pope. African descendant people are focused upon not only with the continent, but throughout the diaspora, throughout the world. And if you're talking about education, teaching traditions, there's Blues Instructions. But don't forget the Blues every noontime hour during the week, the Wednesday edition with Clarence the Bluesman Turner. All good reasons and then some for you to support this station. You have my thanks in advance, along with our staff and the 100-plus programmers that have been here for 48 years due to you. Thank you. Dr. Ramey, we're in that less than a quarter of our show. So much is going on. Dr. Carla Hayden, probably our most important educational figure, was unfairly relieved of her duties as the Librarian of Congress. Seems like anything that is not smacking of a majority superiority mainstream, I hope people catch the ironies and paradoxes and that it's oxymoronic to say that. Anything that doesn't fit into that tight, rigid picture is getting attacked. How should or how can the Black teaching tradition continue to be exercised? Where should it be practiced? What are some of the considerations that you would have us think about?
Well, I would want us to consider how we have always been resilient, resistant, how we have not just survived, but thrived, right? These times today is nothing new. It just is kind of new in our physical bodies, right? But we come from folk that have been here before. And that's very much our ancestral wisdom that we should continue to tap into, right? And so with that being said, I would say when it comes to continuing to keep the Black teaching tradition alive, I would say it's both done within our homes, our communities, our cultural institutions, our spiritual and religious institutions. And then as someone who is an advocate of, you know, this very traditional understanding of teaching and learning, right? I would argue that Black teachers continue to be the Black teaching tradition and in many ways jump at the system that be. And so be an advocate to and fro, not only yourself, but for the young people and the children, particularly those Black faces that you are teaching every single day. As someone who's also an advocate of wanting to cultivate the next generation of future Black teachers, I also believe in supporting the institutions or the formal institutions that are wanting to train those Black teachers, regardless of the policies and systematic structures at play. And so we go back to our HBCUs and their various schools and colleges of education, teaching, training, preparation programs. I also want to look to such programs as the Center for Black Educator Development, right? I want to look at some of these really cultivating institutions. Dr. Lassane, Akoswa Lassane, has the Black Teaching Tradition Institute of Pedagogical Genius, right? That is looking to develop not only our Black teachers, but also becoming leaders in and throughout our communities. And so remembering to that we are the genius, we are the intellectual genealogy, but also the pedagogical genius that has existed both past, present, and future.
And this is a mere acknowledgement of what you just said. Young people bring a sense of not only rootedness in their communities, but that international focus, that focus in non-traditional settings, perhaps the existing institutions, even an older generation, can begin to experience a renewal, you know, possibly Saturday schools. When your non-school setting wants to go on a field trip, everybody should go, maybe, yes. And the thing is, this tradition is not going anywhere, as you said. It is not passing away. I appreciate you for presenting it with all its vitality. And maybe there's even a further last word as far as people beginning to do beginning steps. We have a minute or two. Where do you want this conversation to inspire us to go? What actions would you have us take?
I want us to take the action and to own our teaching and learning of our Black children, right? I want us as a village to be the knowledge. I want us to recognize that we have it and we've always had it, hence why they want to be us, right? And they want that. So if we are able to preserve our intellectual genealogy, but our genius, our great Black genius, I want us to recognize it, but to own it and affirm it, and then to begin to utilize our resources within each other through the formal and the non-formal spaces of teaching and learning. And this tradition alone will continue through time and space. The great lineage of the Black teaching tradition will go beyond the time and space of you and I. And that is the future. And that is what I want to see in terms of action steps of how we are cultivating our great genius and not silencing it, because it might not look like what it did when we were being brought up, but to cultivate our young people and their genius a particular type of way and let them know you are the ones we've been waiting for.
Well, thank you, Dr. Kenya Ramey. Thank you so much, Dr. Ramey. The opening here is that you've given me is Carter G. Woodson. Dr. Woodson said, real education means to inspire people to live more abundantly, to learn to begin with life as they find it, and to make it better. I thank you for your contribution to that cause and effort. My thanks to Mike Nasella, our engineer. In a more formal sense, you know, WPFW is determined to be your jazz and justice station. The perspectives that are offered by our guests and your host, yours truly, are our own, but we do mean to share them. And the affiliations that I share of our guests are used for identification, but I always want you to focus on what is said and understand that is offered from each of us. Again, thank you, Mike Nasella, my engineer. Thank you to the News and Public Affairs Department. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in and sticking with us with this hour. I hope you come back again. And importantly, spread the word, whether it's this program or another program. Tell a friend. Spread the word. It's Black History Month, and we want to honor a very important person who has just recently transitioned. Again, I thank you for listening. Hopefully we'll meet again on the radio. Take care.
System tries to bring you down. Never had to shine at night.
WPFW,
Your station for Jazz and Justice is seeking a leader to serve as WPFW's next general manager. We are looking for someone with strong managerial skills, a commitment to independent media, an appreciation for African American culture and history, and a passion for community service. The general manager will guide WPFW's mission, oversee an extraordinary group of staff and volunteers, and help build the future of this listener-supported community treasure. If you are ready to lead with creativity, integrity, and vision, we want to hear from you. To apply or learn more, visit hr@pacifica.org.
I'm Jackie Lukeman, chairperson of the Black Alliance for Peace Coordinating Committee, with an editorial. Donald Trump imposed federal control of the Metropolitan Police Department and deployed the National Guard in Washington, D.C. under the pretext of public safety. This follows his March 2025 executive order establishing the Safe and Beautiful Task Force aimed at addressing crime in D.C. and after the Secure D.C. Omnibus Bill was passed, the latest in Democrat crime laws that have devastated marginalized communities, particularly Black, African, working class, and youth. Now Trump goes further and invokes law and order to justify military occupation. Militarized domestic occupation that advances as the U.S. and the West deepen their support for the Zionist genocide in Gaza, while they normalize repression of the global masses struggling against and resisting them. We must confront the colonial capitalist structures and oppressive class rule that made all of this possible. We must fight Trump's authoritarianism, but we must also fight Democrat tough-on-crime criminalization of poverty and dissent. And we must fight for a future where safety is not imposed by militarization, but built through structures of popular democracy, peace, social justice, and collective liberation. The Black Alliance for Peace says, end the colonial occupation of Washington, D.C. No justice, no peace, no compromise, no retreat. The full statement can be found at blackallianceforpeace.com/BAP statements. This has been Jackie Lukeman, chairperson of the Black Alliance for Peace Coordinating Committee, with an editorial.
WPFW family, the fun begins on Saturday, September 13th at the WPFW 5K Run Walk for Total Fitness from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. In addition to the 5K, fitness and wellness classes such as Tai Chi, line dancing, breath work, double dutch, and more will be offered along with music to fuel your participation. There is something for everyone to enjoy. This event takes place at the Bladensburg Waterfront Park, 4601 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland. Details are available at wpfwfm.org or 202-888-5484. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Award-winning former police officer and criminal justice adjunct Professor Garland Nixon hosts News Views Fridays at 6 p.m. Tune in to hear a refreshing angle on today's state of affairs and other issues other media intentionally overlooked. Find the episodes on iTunes Podcast and Google Play Music. Only on your station for Jazz and Justice, 89.3 FM, Washington.
Hey, DMV. Sankofa presents a community celebration in the midst of the madness, cuz it's Mama Lucy Murphy's 75th birthday. Hey, ho. Sunday, September 14th, 2 to 6 p.m. at Sankofa Cafe, 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest. The afternoon is a fundraiser for WPFW and will feature an open mic with hosts Esther Ibarra and Nkechi Taifa, just to name a few, and for you to sing, play, or present poetry or hip-hop. An afternoon of collective effervescence, honoring one of our own sheroes and supporting WPFW. Details at sankofa.com.
The United Black Community presents the 21st annual Love Supreme, a musical, poetic birthday tribute to another Ruth, John Coltrane, featuring the NASA Abaday Quintet, Cindy Brown, Kenny Carroll, Nana Malaya, and more on Friday, September 19, 2025 at 7 p.m. at eLife Restaurant, 9033 Central Avenue, Capitol Heights, Maryland. Details, UBC and DC at yahoo.com, 240-832-7203. Thank you.
WPFW presents Genius plus Soul equals Ray and John. Tuesday, September 23rd, 5 a.m. until midnight. This will be a fundraising birthday tribute like no other, illuminating the lives and contributions of Ray Charles and John Coltrane, two icons of American music. Schedule and details at WPFWFM.org. where you can also contribute anytime. WPFW, preserving the culture, one broadcast at a time.